Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I'm so excited that this next speaker is here. If you have been looking at any blogs about the Tudors online at all in the last decade or so, you will have come across her. And it's just such a thrill to be able to have her and to have her share her knowledge with us. So it is Clara Ridgway. Clara Ridgway is a British writer of history books about the Tudor dynasty, with a particular focus on the life of the Boleyn family. Since 2009, she has run the websites theanneboleynfiles.com and elizabethfiles.com, and Claire is also involved in supporting a community history website, The History Files. So I'm so thrilled to have Clara Ridgway here, and we're going to just jump right into the question.
Lightly. They were the family that Anne came from was landed gentry. Mm-hmm. She wasn't common, she wasn't even middle class in the kind of way we'd say it. She was not aristocratic. Her mother's family, the Howards, were, you know, aristocratic. But her, you know, the Boleyns, they weren't aristocracy, but they were wealthy, they were landed gentry. I mean, her great-grandfather was Lord Mayor of London. He was a mercer as well, but he'd risen to be Lord Mayor of London. So landed gentry, I think Gareth Russell sort of explained it really well. He's done a course on the six wives of Henry VIII, the medieval course he's got on. He talks about how in those days, the aristocracy and the gentry sort of mixed. There wasn't quite a class system like we think of it. There was a mix between the gentry and the aristocracy, and it was quite fluid. And so Anne wasn't, you know, this commoner. The Howards, obviously, she was descended from the Howards with her mother being Elizabeth Howard, and they were like one of the premier families of, you know, England. So, you know, that was good blood. I mean, they descended, was it from Thomas Brotherton, I think, who was then the first Duke of Norfolk and son of Edward I. So you've got that aristocracy being in her blood. Mm-hmm. The Boleyns, we don't know much about the Boleyns, their background. I mean, there's this thought that they probably descend from the Counts of Boulogne, hence the name. You see, I mean, there's so many spellings of Boleyn that you see, but one of them is like Boulogne, as in, you know, the place in France. So perhaps they came over with the Norman invasion of William the Conqueror, and Boulogne became Boleyn. Mm-hmm. So there's thoughts like that. But also Thomas Boleyn was descended from the Butlers of Ireland, who were a very wealthy landed family. His grandfather, well, his mother's Lady Margaret Butler, and she was an heiress of her father, Thomas Butler, the Earl of Ormond. And the family seat is the Castle of Kilkenny, which is absolutely stunning. I haven't been there myself. I really want to, but it's stunning. So, you know, she wasn't just this common, you know, woman become lady-in-waiting and then, you know, rose to be queen. It's not. That's not fair to say. It makes great fiction, I think, but not very real, really. Yeah. So yeah, she's a bit of a mixture with who she descends from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean that's a very potted background of them.
Yeah.
And she had royal blood. I mean, there was royal blood in her because, you know, of the Howards. I mean, there were various lines of royal blood. She did, like all of Henry's wives, she had. And the nobility and the gentry were so small in those days. I mean, England didn't have the population that it does today. So, you know, that's why everyone seems to have been related, really.
Yeah, sure. And so can you tell me a little bit, you talked about her family and her ancestors. What about her parents specifically?
Yep, Thomas and Elizabeth. Well, they're both born around the same time. I mean, we don't have specifics because unfortunately parish records, you know, just didn't, they didn't have to register births and that. But we believe that Thomas and Elizabeth were both born around circa 1476-77. Elizabeth Boleyn was the daughter of Thomas Howard, who was Earl of Surrey and was then created later second Duke of Norfolk. She was a child of his marriage to Elizabeth Tilney. As I said, the Howards were one of the premier families of England at the time, very, very important family with a long history of service to the monarch. Unfortunately, they kind of picked the wrong side at the Battle of Bosworth. They were being loyal to their king, you know, and the Howards were on the side of Richard III. So, of course, after Richard was defeated by Henry VII, the Howards then had to really show Henry VII that they could be loyal to him. And they ended up losing the title of Duke of Norfolk for a while. But then were restored once they'd shown loyalty to the new king. Thomas Boleyn was from a Norfolk family, the Boleyns. Both he and Elizabeth are sort of based in East Anglia. That's probably how they got to know each other, how the two families got to know each other. We think that they were married, going on from the jointure of their marriage, and that we think that they were married about 1499 or so, 1498-1499, sort of turn of that century, and that they had at least five children. We know that they definitely had five children. We don't know the age order of them. There's so many arguments about who was born first and what year they were born, because again, no parish records for birth. Mary, Anne, George, and then Thomas and Henry. And we know that Mary, Anne, and George were the only children to actually survive into adulthood. Although Alison Weir has claimed that at least Thomas survived into sort of early adulthood, but I found no evidence of that. And their graves with little crosses on are the types that we use for children. So they're buried in Penshurst and Hever. So that's kind of who they were. Thomas was son of Sir William Boleyn of Blickling, which is in Norfolk, and Lady Margaret Butler. And as I said before, that his paternal grandfather was Sir Geoffrey Boleyn, a wealthy mercer and Lord Mayor of London. And then his maternal grandfather was the Earl of Ormond. So he wasn't, you know, Elizabeth wasn't. It was a good match. You know, some people say that Elizabeth, you know, she should have had a better match being a Howard, but he was a good match. Thomas, he wasn't this commoner. It was a good match for both. Mm. So, and then we have Thomas being, I think he can be described as ambitious, very ambitious and very talented as well. I mean, I've written down some of his early career highlights, just focusing on very early, 1497, so probably just before he married Elizabeth. He fought on the king's side against the rebels of the Cornish Rebellion. 1501, he attended the wedding of Catherine of Aragon and Arthur, Prince of Wales. 1503, he was chosen as part of the escort to take Margaret Tudor to Scotland for her marriage to James IV. 1509, he was chosen as an esquire for the body for Henry VII. And then on the accession of the new king, Henry VIII, he kept that. And he was created a Knight of the Bath as part of the coronation celebrations for Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. So you've got that happening before Henry VIII came to the throne. He was already, you know, on the rise before Henry VIII came along.
Sure, sure. So then their children, when did they first go to either the English court? I suppose in the case of George would have spent time, you write in your book about him spending time with his father in the English court, and then the girls going to France or to Margaret of Austria's court. How did that get arranged, and how did that happen?
Yeah, early education would have been at home. They were of the gentry, so it would have been at home. They would have been educated at home. And Thomas Boleyn, he was like Thomas More and like Anthony Cook later. He was a Renaissance man. He gave his daughters the opportunities that a lot of families would only have given to their sons. You know, he was a humanist. He was interested in education and literature and religion. So you can imagine these children having quite an enlightened education, but it would have started at home. We don't know anything about Mary's sort of early life. In fact, Mary is this blank canvas. She makes great fiction, because you can just do anything with her, because, you know, she's just this blank. So we don't know anything about her or Anne's early education at home. But we know that George was being prepared to follow in his father's footsteps as a diplomat. I mean, Thomas was very gifted with languages. And we know that George could speak French, Latin, and Italian. He was fluent in French. So he was obviously being prepared to sort of follow in his father's footsteps at court. Of course, we have Anne being going to Mechelen in the Low Countries before moving to France. The first record we have of George at court is Christmas 1514, the Christmas period, the 12 days of Christmas, where he's recorded with his father as taking part in the Christmas celebrations in a mummery. So he was being at a mummery, yeah, some kind of mass or play. And then we know at some point following that, he became one of the king's pages. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that he was at court all the time serving the king. Sometimes it was just a sort of a title rather than, you know, you actually being a servant. But he was chosen as one of the king's pages. The next thing we know really about the children is Mary Boleyn being picked to go to France with Mary Tudor, who was being taken off there to marry Louis the 12th, who was quite a bit older than her. But Mary was chosen as a maid of honour. We have Thomas Boleyn, he must have been a real charmer. He must have been very good at negotiating, because when he went over to the Low Countries to negotiate with Margaret of Austria, to negotiate really with her father Maximilian, but sort of Margaret was doing the negotiation, he had such a good relationship with her, became such good friends with her. I mean, they gambled together and they became close. That led to him securing a place at her court for Anne, which, you know, I know I've said that Anne wasn't a commoner, but she also wasn't a princess of Europe. You know, Margaret's household, her sort of maids of honour, were very, very important people, very important women. So that was an amazing opportunity for her. And it shows not only Thomas's closeness to Margaret, but I think it also shows that Anne must have had something about her. I mean, Thomas must have really praised his daughter, you know, to get this place. So we have Anne going off in 1513 to Mechelen to serve as a maid of honour for Margaret of Austria. Then we have her being recalled just a year later, because she then gets chosen with her sister to go and serve Mary Tudor in France. We don't know when Anne arrived in France. We don't know whether she got there in time for the wedding of Mary and Louis, but it was obviously sometime in that autumn. And then, of course, you've got Mary Tudor in the new year. Louis dies. Mm-hmm. Mary Tudor manages to marry Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, and then, of course, returns to England. And I think, I mean, we don't have the records of this, but Mary Boleyn doesn't really come up in the French records after that. Mm-hmm. So I think Mary Boleyn probably went back to England with Mary Tudor and her entourage. But we know that Anne was kept on in France by the new queen, Francis I's wife, Queen Claude, and she went on to serve her. The next we hear of Mary Boleyn is 1520, when she marries William Carey, who's one of Henry VIII's privy chamber. And the next we hear of Anne in England, but we hear of her being recalled from France in late 1521 because there are marriage negotiations with the Butler family, whom she's related to in Ireland, with James Butler. And also she's been chosen to serve Catherine of Aragon. So she gets called back, probably arriving sort of Christmas, I would say. It's late 1521 or early 1522. And we know that she was definitely back for Shrovetide 1522, because in March she plays Perseverance in the Chateau Vert pageant. So we have that. So that's Calais. I don't think I've missed anything out. That's the records we have of them, you know, at court.
Sure. So let's talk about Mary. And there's all these kinds of stories about her and the French king, and then attracting Henry. And what's the truth around the French side to start with, and then how she attracted Henry?
I think Eric Ives got it right when I was talking to him about Mary, and he said to me, what we know about Mary Boleyn could be written on a postcard with room to spare. I did think sometime I might write a Mary Boleyn biography, and it'll just be 2 pages by the rest of the book, just blank. Because she's just this blank canvas. I mean, all we have is rumours, and we have this reputation as her, you know, being this whore, this mare, you know, that the King of France could ride, and all derogatory kind of stuff. But we don't know whether that's just because of the whole blackening of the Boleyn name, but there isn't any definitive evidence of her having an affair with the King of France. There's no hard, nothing concrete at all. But we know that she must have had a sexual relationship at one point with Henry VIII. But we only know that because of a dispensation that Henry applied for when he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, when he'd set his sights on marrying her. In 1527, he applied for a dispensation to marry a woman who, this dispensation was to get around the impediment of affinity. And it said, in whatever degree, even the first. Now that means that he slept with someone that was very closely related to Anne, i.e. her mother or a sister. So that leaves Elizabeth Boleyn or Mary. And when he was sort of confronted later with rumours that he'd slept with Anne's sister and mother, he said never with the mother. But he didn't say, oh, and not with the sister either, you know. So he was kind of saying that he had slept with Mary. But, you know, as I say, Mary's this blank canvas for fiction. So you have, you know, like the other Boleyn girl, you know, Mary. Henry VIII's true love, and they have this long relationship and children, and it's just so romantic, and you know, but we know absolutely nothing about their relationship at all. I mean, most historians date it, and I've been guilty of this in the past as well, dating the start of this affair to early 1522, because you have Henry riding out at the Shrovetide Jousts. Get my words out. At these jousts, these pageants, there was always a theme. There's always this chivalric theme of love or unrequited love. You know, it was very, very medieval. Mm-hmm. And he rode out at this joust with the motto, El mon coeur a navera, she has wounded my heart. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't say Mary Boleyn has wounded my heart or anything. It was she. It was just you know, and this might just have been purely a chivalric theme. But people take that to be, you know, talking about Mary. She's rebuffing his advances, you know, he's heartbroken. But I think that's quite a leap, really. I think it could easily be said that it was just the theme of those Shrovetide celebrations. There was always a theme that Epiphany, for example, there was always a theme for the pageants. Shrovetide was always a theme. So it could just be that he just picked a theme that he liked. He might not have been referring to a specific woman. And if he was referring to a specific woman, it might not have been Mary. It's just too much of a leap. Who's to say it was Mary? And I think as well with the dating of their relationship, if we look at Bessie Blunt, Elizabeth Blunt, who served Catherine of Aragon and who we definitely know was a mistress of Henry VIII because she had his acknowledged legitimate son, the kind of his MO with her was that he had this relationship with her. And then after he'd finished with her, and we don't know whether he just had Henry Fitzroy with her or whether there was a daughter, Elizabeth as well. Elizabeth Norton argues that she also had a daughter with the king. But after he'd finished with Bessie Blunt, he then arranged a really good match for her. You know, he helped her. He organised a good marriage for her. So I kind of think that if you go with that MO, that it's more likely that he slept with Mary, whether it was once, twice, a few months drawn out, who knows, and then arranged a good match for her. William Carey was a good match. He was he was a member of the King's Privy Chamber. He was related to the King as well. He was close to the King. Henry even went to their wedding and gave them a wedding present. I kind of think that, yeah, 1520 organising a marriage for her after the King's finished with her, rather than helping organise a marriage for her and then sleeping with her. Mm-hmm. To me, that really doesn't make sense. But of course, you get people then saying, but look at William Carey. Look at, you know, the records for all the grants he's given, all of these wonderful manors that he's given, all this money. But Henry, you know, Henry VIII is seen as this monster and this tyrant. But if you read through his grants and letters and papers, he was also extraordinarily generous to people who served him loyally and people that were his friends. You see the same names coming up all the time, those that were in his privy chamber, and, you know, like Charles Brandon, Henry Norris, and William Carey. You know, if you say that, oh, well, Henry was rewarding William Carey because he was sleeping with his wife and he was just kind of keeping Carey happy, then you could say that about other men as well. Well, he must have been sleeping with Charles Brandon's wife. Yeah, Mary Tudor. he must have been sleeping with Henry Norris's wife. All these men. No, I don't. Yeah. I mean, it's, you can argue various points, can't you? It just, to me, it kind of makes more sense that he had a relationship with her before matching her with Carey. Mm-hmm. But who knows? Great fiction.
Sure. So do we know anything about how her parents reacted to this first affair with Mary? And then, like we talked about, there's this, the kind of idea that they were sort of pimping their daughters out. Yeah. And so how did they react with Mary? Do we know that? And then how did that inform how they reacted with Anne?
Thomas Boleyn, either he's seen as this weak man who's controlled by his wife and the Duke of Norfolk, who was Elizabeth's brother, his brother-in-law, or you've got Thomas being really, really ambitious and him working along with his wife and the Duke of Norfolk to pimp out their daughters to the king, you know, so that they can advance. You know, they really want, they want the crown, for goodness sake, you know. But that makes good fiction, but has absolutely no basis in historical fact whatsoever. As I said to you earlier, you know, by 1509, Thomas Boleyn was already on the rise. And that was before Henry VIII, you know, came to the throne. And then you have this magnificent rise. It carries on in the same way after Henry VIII comes to the throne. But even before either, even if you go for the date of, you know, prior to 1520 for Mary being involved in things, there's still this great rise before that. His name regularly appears in lists of grants and appointments in the 1510s. He was a royal favourite. He was a trusted diplomat due to his gift for languages. And also, I think he was probably a very diplomatic character as well. He was good at getting what the king wanted. In 1516, he was canopy bearer at Princess Mary's christening. So, you know, that's important. In 1517, he was picked as the official carver for Margaret Tudor's visit to London. He was a member of the King's Privy Council by 1518. So he'd started his rise under Henry VII and had just continued in the same vein under Henry VIII. So Thomas Boleyn had absolutely no need whatsoever to pimp his daughters out to the king. He was already a royal favourite. And perhaps it would have been a risk as well to pimp out his daughters to the king, because if the king hadn't liked it, if something had gone wrong with the kind of the flirtation relationship, then, you know, Thomas might have been blamed and his career might have suffered. It's hard to know how Thomas and Elizabeth felt about Mary's relationship with King. I mean, obviously we don't even know any details about Mary's relationship with King, but there does seem to have been a breakdown in the relationship between Mary and her parents, because when she was widowed in 1528, William Carey sadly died in the big epidemic of setting sickness, the same one that Thomas Boleyn suffered from and Anne Boleyn suffered but survived. William Carey dies, leaving Mary in quite dire straits financially. Probably not as dire straits as poor people, you know, but she was used to a certain level of living. And the king had to actually step in and persuade Thomas Boleyn to actually provide for Mary. So I think that points to some kind of breach in that Thomas Boleyn wasn't already helping her. She was having trouble. And, you know, surely a loving parent who's got a good relationship with his daughter would already be helping provide for her. So I think there was some breakdown there. As far as Anne's relationship with the king, and the king calls him Anne, Chapuis, in one of his dispatches, writes of how the Duke of Norfolk and Thomas Boleyn had actually tried to dissuade the king from marrying. But that doesn't point to either of them pimping Anne out to the king, if they were actually trying to dissuade the king. So I think Thomas was clearly ambitious. He was ambitious for himself and he was ambitious for his children. But I don't believe that his ambition was at the expense of his family, at the expense of his daughters. I don't think that history backs that idea up in any way. Mm-hmm. But great to make him a baddie in fiction.
Right, sure. So what about George Boleyn, who you wrote a book about? Yep. Again, we don't seem to know that much about Jane, his wife, but what can you tell me about their relationship and about what George was doing during this period in his rise?
Unless someone leaves a diary there are letters between husband and wife. There's no details on someone's personal relationship because it is personal and private. But there's certainly no evidence that, I think it was in the Tudors, isn't it, where you see Thomas Boleyn pretty much forcing George down the aisle to marry Jane, and they absolutely hate each other. Well, there's no evidence in the sort of primary sources that George was forced to marry Jane, or that he then was a bully to her and treated her badly. Again, that makes good fiction, but it's not factual. We know the marriage was arranged, but that was perfectly normal for people of their standing to have, you know, matches made between two families that would benefit both families. But we also know from examining sort of marriages at that time, that if someone, either the bride or groom, really detested the person that their family were putting forward, that generally the match wouldn't go ahead. If someone really didn't want it to happen, the match wouldn't have gone ahead. So there's no evidence of either of them opposing the match. They went with it. And also they would have known each other before they got married, because they were both, you know, both families were at court. Both families were sort of East Anglian families. So they would have known each other. So there's no historical evidence of them being forced into it. I mean, George, it's hard to say what his character was like. I'm sure, like many other male courtiers, that he might have been a bit of a ladies' man. You know, while his wife is busy or whatever, perhaps he was a ladies' man. But there's no evidence of him being linked with any particular woman at court. There's no evidence of them having an unhappy marriage. It appears to have been childless, unless you go down the route of George Boleyn, Dean of Lichfield, being a child of theirs. We just don't know. No one's been able to link that George Boleyn definitively to our George Boleyn. People argue that, you know, a childless marriage in those times, where, you know, contraception wasn't good and it was really important to have children to carry on the name, and that we don't know. Jane wasn't very important, and she might have had miscarriages, she might have had stillbirths. There was no need. She wasn't a queen where these things were recorded. And even with the queens, even with Anne Boleyn and Catherine of Aragon, we argue about how many pregnancies they had and that, because the records just don't exist. So she might have had trouble. Or she might have been barren, she might have been infertile. George might have had problems, he might have been infertile. So just because their marriage seems to have been childless does not mean that it was unhappy. We also have this myth, and it is a myth, that Jane hated George so much that she provided evidence to bring down the Boleyns in 1536. She hated George and Anne and was going to do her utmost to bring them down. She is never named in the historical sources as being one of the key witnesses. We have names, Lady Worcester being named by Lancelot de Carle. We have Lady Bridget Wingfield providing posthumous evidence against them. But Jane isn't actually named by any of the contemporary sources. She's named by fictional sources or by late sources, but nothing at the time. And actually in May 1536, after George's arrest, Jane sent him a letter. We don't know exactly what the letter said, but from George's comments and the comments about the letter, it was a letter of comfort, and it said that she was going to petition the king on his behalf. We don't have a record of her petitioning the king, but then some of the letters, some of the documents were damaged in a fire, in the Ashburnham House fire, and are mutilated or missing. So she might have petitioned the king, or she might have realised that actually she'd get nowhere with that. We don't know. So we've got that. And also, what I find is quite poignant is that when Jane was executed alongside Catherine Howard in 1542, an inventory was taken of her possessions, because of course her possessions were then going to be seized by the Crown because she was a traitor. And all her clothes seemed to have been black. Now you could say, well, perhaps Catherine Howard, you know, all her ladies had to wear black, and of course black was expensive, it showed your status. But for all her clothes, all of the fabric to be black, I mean, that kind of suggests to me that she was still in mourning for her husband, and that's not actions of a woman who hated her husband. So you have that, and then you have George's reputation as this rapist as well. I mean, this is based on George Cavendish's Metrical Visions, which is poetry. It's all in verse, and he says of George, "My living bestial, I forced widows, maidens I did deflower. So he makes George out to be a right horrible man. But there's no other evidence of that. There's not even hearsay that George, you know, deflowered maidens and raped widows and that. No one, not even those that disliked George, you know, say that. I mean, Shaftesbury certainly would have, I'm sure, would have jumped on rumours of George being this rapist. And actually, George Cavendish says all kinds of things about the king as well. He uses, he's quite awful about Thomas Culpeper later, and he uses the same kind of language that he uses about George and Thomas Culpeper about King Henry VIII as well. And nobody accuses King Henry VIII of, you know, weird sexual practices, being rapist or being homosexual, which of course was, you know, the worst thing that you could be in those days. So, yeah, it's very myths, but not, again, in historical sources. So yeah. So I don't think, I don't, they might have had an unhappy marriage, who knows, but there's certainly no evidence of it being unhappy.
Sure, sure. So then, Anne and George, what was their relationship like as brother and sister? Can you talk a little bit about that?
They were certainly close, and I think it's because they were very similar. I mean, it's funny that they were close with the fact that Anne obviously spent many years in France, away from her family. But I think her and George were very similar. They were highly intelligent. I kind of, the George and Anne that I get from reading the sources is that they didn't suffer fools gladly. I think they were witty and they could be spiteful as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we know their closeness because of the translations of religious texts that George did for Anne. I mean, that's such a beautiful thing to do for anyone. They were religious texts that he was interested in. He was interested in, you know, the new ideas from the continent. And they were obviously texts that he knew that Anne would be interested in. And I mean, they're just beautiful. They're illuminated. He's got her badge, the Falcon badge, beautifully done. They've got dedications on them, you know. And actually, I can't remember the wording. I haven't written it down for my notes. But it's actually, his dedication to her is quite witty. And it's actually taking the mickey out of her a little bit as well. And it's the wit and the words of someone that loved you, a loving brother who could actually take Mickey Mouse of you without offending you. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would say incredibly close. And you know, Anne, when she got to the tower in 1536, you know, she went straight to, where's my brother? You know, what's happening with my brother? And I think she was consumed with worry over her family, particularly her brother, what was happening with him. It must have been awful with him being executed, you know, the days before her, and knowing that him and her friends, men that she cared about, you know, were being brutally killed in this way. So yeah, I think they were very close. They had shared faith, shared ideals, shared ambition.
Sure.
So I can just, what I want to do, if I could time travel, I'd go and be a fly on the wall when you have George Boleyn and Thomas Wyatt and Anne sort of making up poetry and verses and discussing literature and having a good old gossip as well. Because I think it would have been quite spiteful at times and very witty.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Well, so can you talk to me a bit then about religion? And you talked about the translations and that segues nicely into what Anne will forever be linked, of course, with the Reformation and then moving on to the disillusion. But she wasn't really can you tell me about how she, what she was thinking as she saw the disillusion happen then and that side of her? Yeah.
Gordon had horrible histories on one day when it was talking about, you know, the Reformation and England, you know, swapping between Catholicism and Protestantism, and you know, Henry VIII, one minute he was the next, and you know, Anne Boleyn being Protestant, and I had to come in at that point. I was in the other room and I heard them saying Anne Boleyn Protestant. And going to say, no, no, kids, don't listen to this, because I think it's far too early in the 1530s to use labels like Protestant. It's far too early. You could say it a bit later. You could say it of Anne Askew and Catherine Parr and Catherine Brandon. And that, but you can't, I don't believe you can use the term Protestant in the 1530s, because all of these ideas that were sweeping in from the continent were very, very new. And Anne Boleyn certainly wasn't a Protestant. I think Guy Bedwell, who's written about Jacques Lefebvre de Pape, which is one of the French reformers who Anne was very interested in, she read his books. He described Lefebvre as neither as a Catholic with a bad conscience, nor as a crypto-Protestant, but rather as an evangelical who firmly believed that the truth, when positively proclaimed, would triumph over error. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually is a really, really good description of the Boleyns, particularly Anne. She was influenced by French reform. She'd been for how many years? 7 years at the court, the royal court in France. She'd spent time with Marguerite of Angoulême. I can imagine her discussing these new ideas that were coming out with other maids of Queen Claude. And we know from the literature that she owned, works by Clement Marot, Jacques Lefebvre d'Etat, and these were all French. She wasn't reading works from, well, Germany didn't really exist then, but she wasn't reading Luther. Mm-hmm. Her flavour of reform was definitely French. It was justification by faith. That was definitely, although we link that with Luther, that came from French reform as well, that, you know, you got to heaven, you got saved through your faith in Jesus Christ and through the grace of God. Not by anything that you did, but by accepting Jesus Christ as your saviour. So through Christ alone, so you've got the justification of faith idea. She believed in the authority of Scripture, and she was very much involved as a patron of the Bible in English. She believed that people should be able to read the Bible in English. So she supported the dissemination of the Bible in English and the authority of Scripture, and wanted people to be able to read the Bible for themselves so that they knew what Scripture said. She also believed in this came from French reform as well, living your life to glorify God. There's this whole idea of the Catholic idea of good works and, you know, doing good works to get to heaven and paying your way. Mm-hmm. I'm being very unfair here, but kind of trying to be simplistic. Mm-hmm. But Anne, the reform that she was reading was still an emphasis on good works, charity, good deeds, but that was more to glorify God. And because it was part of a good Christian life, if you believed in Jesus, if you believed in what the Bible said, then you would naturally be doing good works anyway. So these were the kind of ideas coming from France, and this is the literature that Anne was reading. You could call Anne and George evangelical. I think probably had they both survived 1536, they may well have gone on to become like Anne Askew, Catherine Parr, and to become more what we'd call Protestant, because more ideas were flooding in. But yeah, I would say she was an evangelical woman with a personal faith, but she was still a Catholic. She did not, she refused to be a patron of, I think it was Tristan Revel's work, because that was actually against the miracle of the Mass. She didn't go so far as denying transubstantiation, denying the miracle of communion. She didn't go that far. So she wasn't a radical in that way. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, had time gone on, then she might well have become more Protestant. I don't believe, I think it was G.W. Bernard who says that because you can't label her Protestant, then actually she was a closet Catholic and wasn't interested in reform at all. Or the idea that the Boleyns were only interested in reform because it was fashionable, mm-hmm. and, you know, would help them with their rise, you know, with their ambition. But that can't be said. Anne seems to, but clearly, had a personal faith. She kept the Bible out in her room. She encouraged her ladies to read it. She received manuscripts from George that were religious texts. I mean, you don't give someone religious texts and they're not at all interested. No. And then we also have her father, Thomas. Sometimes he's seen as this reformer. Other times he's seen as not sharing his children's faith. Mm-hmm. But he actually, let me find my notes. It's Thomas Tebold. Or Tebold, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. He was godson of Thomas Boleyn, and he actually went off to the continent, and he was reporting back to Thomas Boleyn on the state of the kind of religion on the continent, what was going on with regards to reform, he had links with French reformers, how are they being persecuted. So he was reporting back, and he was also linked to Cromwell as well. He was one of Cromwell's agents. But it says that he was travelling in Europe, supported by the Earl of Wiltshire, feeding back on the religious persecution. But he also sent Thomas Boleyn an epistle by the French reformer Clement Marot, which Anne read his literature too. He'd been forced to flee France due to his religious views. And Tebold says that he hopes to hear from Thomas Boleyn via Reynold Wolfe, bookseller of St. Paul's Churchyard. And when you dig into Reginald or Reynold Wolfe, he's a reformer. His bookshop is this kind of this place in London where reformers, you know, go to kind of share ideas and that. So Thomas Boleyn was definitely a reformer as well. There's just too much evidence of him supporting reform, being a patron of reform, to say that he wasn't interested in the same ideas as his children.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to remember how many books Anne Boleyn owned that were religious. Oh, here it is. Eric Ives wrote about how there's 9 books that still exist that belong to Anne and George, one or the other. 7 are religious and 6 of those are reformist in character.
Mm.
So, you know, Anne and George were reading literature that was cutting edge, mm-hmm. new ideas. So, and of course, yeah, Tyndale's English Bible, she supported. It was available to her household. But as far as the Reformation is concerned, you have this idea of Anne Boleyn starting the English Reformation all by herself, you know. but no, I mean, she obviously, being a patron of reformers, and we certainly know that she helps people within the church rise within the church due to her influence and patronage. And of course, she was Henry VIII's wife. You know, she did mark this passage, you know, in the Obedience of a Christian Man, where it talks about rulers only being answerable to Christ himself, to God. Rather than, you know, this idea that a ruler was under the dominion of the Pope. Mm-hmm. And so Henry VIII latched onto this, not because Henry VIII was, wanting to be a Protestant or was affected by these religious ideas. It would help him with his annulment. So that's mm-hmm. all he wanted. The break with Rome is more to do with Henry's quest for an annulment rather than Henry VIII wanting to get rid of Catholicism in England. So we have her influence. We have her being more of a catalyst, I would say. than being someone that actually started the Reformation.
Sure.
You can't deny her true faith and her patronage. She helped reformers. We have her helping Nicholas Bourbon escape prison in France, and he came over and she helped to organise his employment. He taught Henry Carey, her nephew, and I think Henry Norris's children as well. And she helped people escape persecution and that. But yeah, she didn't start the Reformation in England, really. That's going too far.
Right, okay. Great. So I've reached the end of my questions.
Well, I could talk about the blends all day, but
no, but you've been so generous with your time. Now I want to give you a chance to plug all your stuff, because you've got a lot of stuff happening. Yeah. How can people get more involved with you and your books and your courses and your all of that? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm probably spreading myself far too thinly, and there aren't enough hours in the day for everything I do. I still blog for the Anne Boleyn Files. That's ongoing, I think. Since 2009, February 2009, which is coming, the anniversary of that. So,
yeah,
9 years.
So that's my podcast started in 2009. Good things started in 2009.
Yeah, 2009 was the
500th
year.
Anniversary. Yeah.
I spend quite a lot of my week on the Tudor Society. I started that summer of 2014. I do a lot of work on that because every week I do a video talk every Friday on a certain theme. At the moment, I've just been doing a series on Catherine of Aragon's pregnancies, for example. So I spend a lot of time doing research and writing for the Tudor Society. And that's one thing. Medievalcourses.com. I mean, I've done one course for that. I've done the life of Anne Boleyn, which covers from her birth to, you know, execution, her legacy, and I've worked with Gareth Russell's done a course for it, Samantha Morris on the Borgias, Tony Mount has done some medieval courses for that, so I've been doing that as well. What else am I reading? Oh, I've said this is my year. I've promised myself. I've had some projects on the back burner for years now, and you kind of lose track of them. Yeah, the Fall of Catherine Howard, a countdown. I have promised myself that if it doesn't get published this year, at least it will kind of get nearly finished this year. She's been waiting for me since 2012 now. I actually started researching that book. And, you know, things get in the way, other projects come up, but I've said that it's going to be Catherine's year. I'm going to finally get that done. And that will be the same format as the Fall of Anne Boleyn countdown, just counting down the days. I've been sort of arguing with myself about how I'm going to start the book, whether it's going to start from the kind of All Hallows, Cranmer leaving the message for Henry VIII about Catherine, because that I think is probably the real date that her fall began. But then you could say that her fall began when she became queen. So I've been arguing with myself. But yeah, that's going to be day by day account of, you know, all of the events that led to Catherine's fall and execution. What else have I got in the pipeline? I've been working with Dmitry Yakovsky, an artist who's just published a book with Deborah Biani, author of a biography of Jasper Tudor. They've just done a colouring book on the Wars of the Roses. And just before Christmas it was, Dmitry sent me some pages that he'd done on Anne Boleyn. And he actually did one for Anne Boleyn False Advent Calendar. He did an Anne Boleyn colouring. And so I kind of been persuaded to do a Life of Anne Boleyn colouring book as well. Mm-hmm. So that will be text from me and not artwork from me, because you would not like artwork from me, and artwork by Dmitry. So that's ongoing. I've been throwing myself into French and Italian and all sorts of contemporary sources about Anne Boleyn's fall and execution, and doing some translation then. So that's a project I'd like to put out sometime, is bringing these translating them into English and sort of sharing them with a wider audience rather than just planets being able to use them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, life is crazy.
So when do you
see... Life is good. Being neck deep, in fact, not even neck deep, it's this deep in Tudor history every day is the dream come true, really.
So
I would say that Tudor society is probably my main thing. It's what takes up most of my time at the moment. I really enjoy that because I just like the community aspect of it. So other Tudor history lovers, other people that when you talk Tudor, people's eyes don't glaze over. They actually, you know, they're interested in what you have to say. Oh, and also tours. I'm going on two tours this year as well.
Okay.
I used to do the Anne Boleyn experience with the Anne Boleyn Files a few years ago. Taking people to the Tower of London, Hampton Court Palace, and staying at Hever. Mm-hmm. And I've decided to buddy up with British History Tours, Philippa Lacey Brawl, and run that again. And we're also doing a Discover the Tudors tour in September. So yeah, Tudor, Tudor, Tudor.
Great, all Tudor all the time.
Yes, but this is my year. If my book doesn't come out by the end of the year, Catherine Howard has still not been mentioned at all, then mm-hmm. everyone needs to write to me and say, where is it?
Okay, perfect. We'll hold you accountable to that.
Yes, you have to.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking your time and sharing all about the families. I've learned so much. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. As I said, any excuse to talk Tudor and I'm there.
That's perfect.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.